Welcome into the KSRO Kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, and we have, count them, three guests today. Have we ever had, we had three guests occasionally.
Yeah.
But never from Boulder, Utah have we had.
Where is that?
Well, let's ask one of the co-authors, Jen Castle, to speak to that. Jen is the co-author, along with Blake Spaulding. Hello, Blake.
Hi, nice to be here with you.
And Lavinia Spaulding.
Hello.
Of both of these books, the first, With a Measure of Grace, The Story and Recipes of a Small Town Restaurant, from 2004. And then the new book from 2017, This Immeasurable Place, Food and Farming from the Edge of Wilderness. And the edge of wilderness is really not an exaggeration, is it?
It's really not.
Where is Boulder, Utah?
It's considered the most remote town in the lower 48. It's south central Utah between Capitol Reef and Bryce National Parks on Highway 12.
And how big is Boulder?
There's about 200 people.
It's tiny. Except during the
but
season.
But it's massive, right, Blake?
Yeah, it's a very small population in a very huge place. Mm. Like the town itself, geographically, is actually the size of Manhattan, 21 square miles. But there's only about, between 200 and 300 people that live there.
So you guys created this amazing restaurant there. What drew you to Boulder?
Well, it was very clear that it was the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. So the monument was declared by President Clinton in 1996, and we moved there at the very end of 99 to start our business venture and opened our doors in February of 2000.
Simple. Why would you not choose?
Well, so isn't one of the principles of a restaurant is you want to have a lot of local customers and things like that to support you and keep you in business?
We had a feeling about it. Both Jen and I had worked in Grand Canyon as on-river cooks, and so really understanding the power and value of a extraordinary wild place with a lovingly prepared meal, we felt like there was an opportunity to bring people happiness. And the place is truly sublime. It's extraordinary. There's no other place like it on planet Earth. And our first few years were really quiet, like we did in our entire first couple of years. You know, our whole year revenue was probably like what now the business volume that we see in 1 month. But it gave us time to kind of learn, make a lot of new recipes and start a farm and make a book. So we just kept plodding along.
So would you talk about Grand Escalante and what that is? And it's kind of also part of this book is dedicated to the idea of helping people understand what's there and its danger. I guess the danger that part of it may go away.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild. Like a little backstory, John, is that when we went to make our second cookbook, we knew we wanted to call it This Immeasurable Place. And it was a reference to the extraordinary landscape. And the story that we decided we wanted to tell, my sister and Jen and I, was about our love affair with Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And then we worked really, 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 really hard on it for 5 years. And lots of things happened. Lavinia had a baby, and I was in a plane crash.
Oh, no.
And all kinds of stuff occurred that kind of kept us from completing it on the timeline that we had thought we would. And so wildly, and, you know, kismet or not, the book arrived in our hands the very week that President Trump signed the executive order to slash it in half, and unfortunately not even like in a normal half, but he made it into three tiny interior island monuments contiguous to nothing, you know, so the most absolutely cruel, damaging situation that could happen to a place that remarkable.
So will there be a grassroots, or is there a grassroots campaign to save this treasure?
There's a grassroots campaign. There's also like a massroots campaign. I mean, most Americans don't approve of the cutting of the monuments. I really believe that in the long run we will prevail, because what happened really is that the president just stole all Americans' birthright. And the reason they stated, the stated reason, not a conspiracy or theory, but actually what they're saying is they took the land so that they can lease them out to oil and gas extractive industry, fracking and like that. And they're still going to be administered by the BLM, but the new sort of version of the BLM is all about extractive industry rights. And so they will destroy this land for very short, ill-gotten gains, and then it will never be what we currently have. So our fight, Jen and I, for this landscape is really not about our restaurant. Like, our restaurant is uncomfortably busy. We are, seeing growth of like 20% a year. It's really hard to manage and keep up with. But it's really the case that my sister Lavinia has a 3-year-old little boy who Jen and I love so much. And we are in this fight for his grandchildren, so our efforts are really about trying to be good ancestors, and for the future. And we were just talking on the way over in the car about how, like, there's kind of a burgeoning movement in the environmental world, maybe not so much in America, but in other countries like Iceland, where natural places are being considered to have distinct rights on their own, like that they even, we're not the only people. Well, we are the only people, but we're not the only species on planet Earth. And wild places should have some rights too, and the beings and creatures that live in them. It's kind of a novel idea, but I'm liking how it sounds.
The name of the restaurant is?
Hell's Backbone Grill and Farm.
Say it again.
Hell's Backbone Grill and Farm.
Okay. And how did it get that name?
Yeah, so when you come there, because I know you're going to come visit us, I can feel it in my bones.
Without a reservation.
I'll find you a spot. We always do.
We'll just show up.
You what? Don't show up.
Just get a place to stay. But you can show. Yeah, we'll find a seat for you.
Okay. Yeah, the hard part is lodging, unless you like to camp. But because camping in Grand Staircase, that's one of the amazing things, is you can camp anywhere for free. It's not like a national park. It's a free experience of being in the wilderness. Hell's Backbone is a very famous chasm, and it was bridged in the 1920s by the Army Civilian Corps and made literally the first road in and out of Boulder. And so Boulder was a land island prior to that bridge. And so Hell's Backbone Bridge is a really extraordinary landmark in the area. So we liked the bridge metaphor.
There was some remarkable dates that stuck in my mind. In 1933, the first automobile. 1942, the last mule train mail service in the country. And 1947, electricity.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a remote outpost for sure. It's still like a kind of... we're used to it because we've lived there a long time now, but people come and they're like, where are we? We have to do this whole like multi-day orientation with new staff to help them understand how to really be and thrive there.
So you knew you were moving to a city that was predominantly Mormon, and that you would face challenges being accepted by the community and certainly serving alcohol. How did you approach that?
I want to backtrack just a little and say that actually the Mormon population there is wonderful, and they were, initially, I would say, sort of wary of us, probably, but we did a nice job of sincerely applying ourselves to making friends and being part of the community. When we moved there, there had historically never been a liquor license in that town. And we sort of got to know the town council, and then we just approached them after our first season we started the negotiations. So we did one full season and then started asking about it. And then we did a whole nother season without any alcohol. And then we opened for our third season with a beer and wine license.
So you make the point in the book that having the ability to sell alcohol is what keeps many most restaurants in business. You know, it's the place where you can make some money.
I mean, in Utah, it's a little different than that because Utah, it's a state-controlled alcohol system. So even though we have to pay money to be licensees, we have to pay full retail for all of our alcohol. Yeah. So it's not like the money, the cash cow that it might be in a different state. But for us, it's more to the point of like we make really nice food. Jen and I love wine, you know, good wine. And so we want to be able to offer that quality of experience of, you know, craft cocktails and beautiful wine
and
nice beers.
Well, the book is full of just yummy sounding drinks of all kinds, you know,
which
is great. Yeah. Which is really great.
Before we take a break, just this touch on the somewhat antiquated, somewhat might say repressive alcohol laws as far as storing and serving. You can't serve someone a drink unless they have a bite of food. Is that correct?
That is correct. They have to have something. I mean, it's sort of like complicated. The thing that's, well, no, I let me
There's
rephrase
a dance.
That. It's wildly complicated. And then every time, the Utah legislature only meets for 45 days a year. But every time they meet, they tinker with the laws. And then it's up to us to sort of like figure out what changed. Like it's fairly chaotic, actually. Mm-hmm. And then they make money from the alcohol sales, but then they also task, like, the Department of Public, the deputies, the sheriffs, with the job of making sure that we are compliant. And so they can come and send in undercover cops to try to see if we'll break our liquor laws. And then they get money for charging fines. And so it's pretty intense.
But I love that. It's called the Behave State Snack of Compliance.
That's what we call it.
Is that what you call it?
Actually, our compliance officer was like, take that off. We had it on the menu as the Behave State Snack of Compliance, just to be snarky. And he was like, this is not a good time to be snarky.
So for people
get rid of that.
People who don't know, it's the Beehive State.
It's the Beehive State.
But you changed it.
We get all these wonderful, like, for reals, like, amazing clientele from California. Lots of guests come to our place from California. And they'll, like, bring their beautiful bottle of wine or something. And, you know, maybe they've opened it in their room and you can't bring it in if it's opened. Sure. And I have to be like, so I came up with this sort of little song and dance routine where I explain about it's called the Beehive State, but it's really the Behave State, and they're going to have to return that open bottle of wine to their room. But I will gladly lend them some of our Riedel glasses that they can drink it on their deck later.
That's hospitality. Yeah. We'll take a break at that point. We have Lavinia Spaulding, we have Blake Spaulding, and Jennifer Castle, all who are combined their efforts to create this magnificent restaurant in Boulder, Utah. I know you want to say Colorado, but it's Utah, and they've written two books. The first one was With a Measure of Grace, which came out in 2004, and the most recent one, 2017, The Immeasurable Place. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, in the KS Ardo Kitchen. In the KS Ardo Kitchen, the authors of both With a Measure of Grace and The Immeasurable Place, two cookbooks that chronicle the development and ongoing efforts of an incredible restaurant located in Boulder, Utah, right on Highway 12, isn't it? We have a Highway 12 here in Sonoma County, but I don't think it's the same one. So you have some visibility along Highway 12, which I understand was a magnificent state, one of the great highways of America.
Yeah, it's a scenic byway. There's only, I think, gosh, maybe I might be making this up. I think there's only like 8 or 9 of them.
It's
in the country.
All-American highway.
Yeah, but it's ours is the only one in Utah. And it is truly like the most unbelievably beautiful drive.
So can you describe where this is at? Because I think one of the things when I got into this, it's like the restaurant's at 7,000 feet, which means short growing seasons, all of that stuff.
Correct, yeah.
You're way the heck away from any source of, you don't call up your wholesaler and sort of say, tomorrow I need the whatever, you know, to be delivered. But can you describe that?
Yeah. You're right. Good catch. We are at almost 7,000 feet in an area that's kind of known as the Aquarius Plateau. We are right tucked under Boulder Mountain, which is the highest forested steppe plateau in North America. And it was supposed to be called Thousand Lake Mountain, but it got transposed with Boulder Mountain, which is some distance away in the first maps. So Boulder Mountain is covered with lakes where we are, and Thousand Lake Mountain is covered with boulders where they are over at the other part of the at one county over. And so it's a remarkable place where, you know, we it's white sandstone buttes, these red capped mesas, and the photos in the new book were taken by a really remarkable photographer friend of ours named Ace Cavalli. He's quite a famous photographer. And if you look at like the opening and closing pages, mm-hmm. the end pages, one is he did a beautiful job of capturing Grand Staircase at sunrise, and then the book ends with Grand Staircase at sunset. But we call the book This Immeasurable Place. I don't mean to be corrective, but it's actually This Immeasurable, not The. But we call it that because it's inconceivable how vast and how beautiful and how unknowable it really is. I mean, Jen and I have been there now for 19 years, and we walk all the time, but there's no way to ever sort of get your arms around the place because it's so immeasurable.
And it's so remote that you had to start another business, and that is to become farmers.
That's true.
To supply so much. You know, those are two separate businesses. I mean, one is a full-time business.
You're so right about that, and it has not been easy. But we started, you know, I mean, Jen and I were really inspired by Alice Waters and Nora Pulleyan and the people who started the Herb Farm outside of Seattle. And so that was the kind of restaurant we wanted to have anyway. But when we started our restaurant, farm-to-table restaurants weren't a thing except on the coasts, and certainly not in like the most rural part of the country. But so we opened right away. When we opened, we started a pretty substantial garden. Then we made another garden in my big backyard at my house. And then we kind of realized we either needed to get all the way out of gardening or get into farming, and we made the decision to get into farming. So we bought a property, a 6.5-acre property, and started actually farming it. And it's evolved now. We have, this year we'll have 4 full-time farmers. We work with the Woofer program. Our farmers are amazing. They're like young millennial, passionate about growing food, college-educated, brilliant humans. And they're so into it. Like, they inspire Jen and I like you can't believe. And they love to grow really good food. So it's not just that they're growing, like, quantity of food. Like, they work with science. Like, one of our farmers has an engineering degree and is a classical pianist. But she, you know, they're always trying to figure out how do we make it more delicious. And they're so good at it. It's really something. And so then we also work with a Woofer program, which is...
What is that?
Woofer is Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. It's a nonprofit that sources for people who want to sincerely learn about farming. They can apply to go and be volunteers in a kind of teaching or learning way at accredited farms. And so we have Woofers that come every year. And that's a great program because then sometimes they fall in love and want to stay and work, because getting employees is complicated because, you know, in order for us to get a new employee, we really have to convince them to move to live in our town. And then there's no housing. So we actually have a third business, which is a sort of staff housing project that Jen and I by necessity had to make happen.
Talk about the salt.
The salt.
You worship this local salt.
We really do.
It's
How
delicious.
Did you know? Yeah, Jen has some in her purse right now, I betcha. Yeah. It's an amazing salt. It's actually won tons of awards. It's a Utah company called Redmond Real Salt. And it's a salt mine it was a salt deposit that came about in Jurassic times and then was capped by a volcano. And I'm not totally sure how they found it, but it's super pure. Consequently, unlike sea salt, which has, of course, now, because our oceans are polluted, the sea salt we eat is sadly mostly polluted too. And so this is an incredibly clean, mineral-intensive salt. And it's not as salty as sea salt. It's delicious. I mean, Jen pours it in her hands and just eats it out of her hand when she needs to pick
and
me up.
It's really pretty.
It's really pretty.
That kind of pinkish-reddish color to it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, we love the salt.
Can you order it online?
Uh-huh. You can. You can order it through our online store, hell'sbackbonegrill.com, along with our cookbooks and all of our other various packaged items, because we have a retail line of food, too.
One of the things in the book that is so interesting, so it's divided into the four seasons, even though you're only working, the restaurant's only open for three seasons.
It's correct.
not open in the wintertime. But it really is kind of a love story of all of the people that you work with and the people that, some of whom are still there and some who have gone to other places, but come back and volunteer again.
Let's pick up that question when we come back from this break.
Great.
Okay. The book is This Immeasurable Place. That's the new one. The first one is With a Measure of Grace, co-written by Lavinia Spaulding and Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle. And they're here visiting from Boulder, Utah, because the restaurant is closed for the season, for the winter. That's why you're able to come out and chat with folks around the country about the new books, which is nice. John Ash and Steve Garner in the K.S. Arto Kitchen. In the K.S. Arto Kitchen, Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash, and you had asked our authors about all the incredibly articulate and bright people that you've attracted to Boulder, Utah over the last 18, 19 years.
Well, one of the key kind of core principles truth in Buddhism is interdependence, right? So nothing happens independently. If you really meditate on that, there's nothing that isn't, that has independent origination, right? Everything is interdependent. And so our restaurant, you know, it could never exist if it weren't for the people who work with us. Jen and I are the chefs, you know, insofar as we are the leaders, the bosses, we run the business, we design new dishes, but we have a crew of almost 45 people, and most of them, they are quirky. You know, it's not like a normal person who's going to move to the most remote town in the lower 48 and come to work for us. But we have a really high employee retention rate, and you know, even people will come and go over the course of a season. You know, we have people who do other really interesting things, and they're like, now I can come work for a month. And we're like, hurry home, we need you. Mm. But, it's a real privilege to work with the people we do. And Jen and I try to have a really humane, loving, intention-driven kind of workplace we have really strong value system around caring for our people.
So do you have a story about the visiting monks that come and stay with you every year?
Yeah. Richard Gear started this program called Mystical Arts of Tibet many years ago to help bring recognition and funding for one of the Dalai Lama's monasteries in South India. And so recognition understanding of the plight of the Tibetan people, because most of those monks are refugees from Tibet in South India, along, you know, with His Holiness. And so these monks they're extraordinary. We invite them to come visit us, and some years it works.
Lead prayer chants or activities when they're there?
Typically, we ask them what they want to do and how long they have. Sometimes they'll make a sand mandala for world peace. Sometimes they will do a mystical arts performance. Mm-hmm.
And do they cook?
Do they cook when they're there, John?
Are they in the kitchen with you?
Sometimes we'll have a big lunch where they make the momos with us serve it to all our staff and any visitors. It's super fun.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. A lot of the recipes in the book, I don't think you said this, but I sense came from the fact, from your farm, that suddenly you have tons of green beans or tons of radishes or something like that. And it's like, what are we going to do with all of this stuff?
Arugula pesto.
Arugula pesto. Yeah, yeah. That
too much arugula. What are we going to do?
Yeah, yeah. And but it's fascinating because what it does is it kind of opens up a whole world of flavors and techniques and things like that that you wouldn't otherwise have. So I like it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really cool, and it's a different way to look at things. You use it till it's gone. There's only one food delivery a week other than our farm, which is during growing season, you know, or what we pull from the freezer that we preserved last year.
Well, I understand you're the crazed canner, freezer, dehydrator.
I try to convert other people.
All of those things to make sure that you have stuff later in the year.
Because you mentioned when you open in spring, there's very little produce available, so you rely on the 1,000 pounds of pumpkin that you've canned back in the fall to be creative. Your next cookbook could be the pinon cookbook, actually, because there's so many recipes for pinon. It's so versatile.
You haven't had Blake's butter mints.
Did you bring any?
No, I really wish I had. Everyone's asking me. I brought my sister one jar, and people are like, can I taste one? I think I'm going to have to steal them back from her and hand out one at a time.
Nope.
And do you get those pinons from Utah, from New Mexico, or where are they harvested?
Well, the pinon, we have a man in town who makes a pinon essence from, it's pinon oil. And so that's one of the things. And then we're surrounded by a pinon tree forest. I mean, that's really what those are the trees that are in Grand Staircase.
There's all kinds of great desserts in there that I'd love to try.
Especially
the sticky buns.
Jen's sticky buns, they're so good.
Are they good?
They're delicious.
They're insanely good.
Yeah, I make sticky buns. I try every sticky bun in San Francisco and the Bay Area. We should do a sticky bun show sometime.
Watch the title.
That would be great. But the requirement.
Oh, thank you.
The requirement to be on air is you have to bring a sticky bun.
Well, I will. And the brittle. The pinon brittle. That's another one. Anyway, I get easily veered off.
We should have brought that this morning.
We have the pinon brittle with us. I'm so sorry.
Oh, we love people like that tell us we had it, but we didn't bring it.
So the book is divided into these three seasons, but it's really more importantly about the people. And I love some of the things that you talk about, like the chapter, I guess, titled "What the Cluck," which is about chickens. And you have chickens. You have many chickens.
We have a lot of chickens.
Yeah, but not to eat the chicken.
Correct, yeah.
For their eggs.
They're eggs. They're also farm workers. Mm-hmm. I mean, chickens are one way to do carbon sequestration. You know, in a farm, basically, they eat. We have a really rigorous program of buckets. So every single plate that gets returned with even 3 grains of rice on it, the 3 grains of rice get scraped into the chicken buckets. And then the chicken buckets get picked up by the farmers in the morning, and they go to feed the hens. And that is a way, because we don't have to pay for grain for our hens for, you know, most of the year, we can let them, you know, affordably let them live out their natural lives. So sometimes I feel like I'm running an old folks' home for geriatric chickens, you know, that some of them look kind of rough.
But
I love them, you know. Yeah. And what they do is they eat the grasshoppers, they scratch up the rhizomaceous grasses. And honestly, they provide the most perfect nitrogen fertilizer in by way of their waste.
Well, you talk about in the book, again, it goes back to this farming aspect, that because of these animals and because where you're at is not what you would call the most fertile place in the world, sand and hardcap and all of that stuff. But I love that there was a little quote in there that you said, what we really grow is soil.
It's true.
That's the most important aspect of your farming operations.
Yeah, and our farmers, Tony and Kate, they're really committed to that. So they're constantly working various kinds of compost. We do stuff with mycorrhizal fungal spores. Mm-hmm. We have the farm animals very intentionally because they put back into the soil. You know, one of the great fallacies or misunderstandings around, like, conventional produce, I mean, is that your food is only as good as the soil you're growing it in. because it's pulling everything that's good for you out of the dirt, and then it manifests. People sort of think, again, back to the interdependence. Yeah. They think this head of broccoli is like its own unique thing, but it's only as good for you as the soil it was grown in. And so people come to the restaurant and they're like, oh my gosh, this is the most amazing, you know, whatever. What?
Carrot
I've ever had. Yeah. How does it be so good? You're such good cooks. And we're like, it's just cooked in a little butter. It's the Redmond salt. It's not, it's the carrot itself, because the soil that, that Tony and Kate produce is so remarkable that it makes really flavorful.
So what's Lemony Cluck? That's a famous dish, isn't it, for the restaurant?
It's kind of a dish I made up to make all my happy food bells chime. It's what I my staff teases me, because I basically can never take it off the menu because I want to eat it four nights a week. Yeah. But it's a chicken and rice dish, really simple, with farm shallots and kind of bright with lemon and a little white wine and a whole lot of butter.
Well, you start it in the hot skillet and butter, and then you finish it in the oven. Mm-hmm. And you brine it, don't you, beforehand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was one of my starred recipes.
Did you try it? It's really good.
Not yet, but it's starred.
Yeah, mine is too. And the other one is that, which I really love, because you guys do imbibe every once in a while, is the pickled everything Bloody Mary, which I thought was
so
great.
Good.
That sounds so delicious.
It's a superlative Bloody Mary.
We'll be back, and we'll come back with the final 10, 12 minutes with our guests. Two cookbooks. We'll focus on This Immeasurable Place, the new one, when we come back and grab some recipes out of that one. The first one is With a Measure of Grace, both chronicling the, I guess, trials and tribulations with it.
It's our origin story.
Origin story of creating their remarkable restaurant in the middle of Boulder, Utah. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen. 3, 2, 1. With Lavinia Spaulding, with Blake Spaulding, and with Jennifer, you have a last name too, Castle. Yes, it's way to go. The two cookbooks, This Immeasurable Place and With a Measure of Grace, based on the recipes and lives that they live in Utah, and that is in Boulder, Utah.
Let me ask, what are country manners? I love that page in which you... It's when you come to Boulder, these are things you need to be cognizant of if you're going to visit there.
Well, it kind of started out of an idea that we were playing with, my sister and Jen and I, around like how to be a reasonable human in a rural setting. Because, you know, people come with their city ways, and I love visiting cities, but it can be kind of abrasive sometimes because people expect things to happen in a certain timeline, and there's a lot of ways to be cool in the country that are very different than being cool in the city, I guess. What do you think? Is that about right?
I was thinking Vinny should talk about it, because it all started with that finger wave.
The finger wave, yeah. You never lift your hand all the way off the steering wheel. That just screams tourist. You just lift a few fingers, and the other person in the other car lifts their
demonstrate
fingers.
That on the radio.
but the real point is, it's one of the things that happened when we first moved there was somebody got mad because they said Jen never waved.
Jen's too neat to wave.
Yeah, and we didn't realize, because we came from Flagstaff, you know, you don't wave at every car
every
that
single
passes
car.
You. But in Boulder, every time you pass a car, you do the finger wave. Mm. So you stick your finger up off the steering wheel, or you do a little like this. I'm more like a this.
But I also, we do that here, but I think it's pretty, we
it's
stick a finger up.
Yeah, no, it's not like that. It's very sweet, but you if you don't do it, people think they know you're a tourist, eh?
And I also love the suggestions for our entrenched profanities that all of us carry with us. And I've started using this one as of yesterday. Cheese and rice. Cheese and rice. And that was a great one. And then the other one, which I'm having a tough time getting, is get down, sat on a bench.
Yeah. Good job. You got it.
Well, I'm trying.
Perfect. I love
really
shut the front
trying.
Door.
That was just beautiful that... you need to be cognizant of these things when you move into the community.
So, Jen, can I ask you about the genesis of this dish, which I thought was brilliant, and that's the tamales dolmades, which sounds really great. And it makes so much sense. So it's a tamale, but wrapped
in a grape leaf.
Wrapped in grape
leaves. We have beautiful grapevines all over the place. Oh. And we don't always have the hoja, the corn husk for the tamales. And I don't know what it was, but there was some reason that one day I decided to try to wrap them up and make, you know, a mini bite. And it worked. And it tastes so delicious just to wrap that tamale and eat the wrapper. But I did it this late in the summer this year, and I used older grape leaves, and it was terrible. And I had to I had to discard the grape leaves and just eat the yummy inside, which is still good and comes away from the wrapper as it should. But it's pretty cool to use the young ones and then just take that bite.
So are these wild grapes? Are they cultivated?
They probably were. Some pioneer of them were grapes. Planted by pioneer families, and then we plant more now. Jen's family lineage is kind of old New Mexican, you know, through her grandmother's side. And so we have a lot of dishes that are sort of matrilineal on her family side, tamales and enchiladas. Yeah. We call them Jenchiladas because they have a Jen spin on them. They're so good.
The beer program is very robust, too. And not without a hint of irony, the... Polygamy Porter was one that caught my ear.
There's a great Utah company, Wasatch Squatters, and they
can't have just one.
Yeah, that's their design. No, they say, why have just one? Why?
So a lot of the beers are locally produced? Utah-based beers.
Utah is really interesting because as sort of antediluvian as the liquor laws are, there's a very, to use your word, sort of robust craft making of spirits and beer, particularly. Less so wine, although we work with one local winemaker who's amazing, Evan Lewandowski. He makes the Ruth Lewandowski natural wines, and they're brilliant, and he's getting all kinds of famous. So, yeah, there's all sorts of distilleries
and bitter
makers and things like that. Against all odds.
Against all odds. Mm. So with spring coming soon, you'll use the larder from September, October, November, December, and then you'll start kind of small. And is it a big crush that people show up right when the doors open?
I have to say that they do. Yeah. We were sort of horrified. We were expecting to have like at least a week or two to train our new staff. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, my gosh, we have a lot of reservations for opening night. We're gonna be crushed. And we stayed crushed all year. But it's really sweet. I mean, I will say, sort of back to the Grand Staircase thing, when the executive order was made a year ago, you know, well, really, when the new administration came in, we saw what was going to happen, that the monument would go away. And Jen and I decided to come out really strongly for the monument and really, you know, message that everywhere we could. And we were really sure and ready to sort of experience the deleterious effects of that. We thought, you know, we would lose customers, but we were going to do the right thing regardless. And to our kind of amazement, the opposite has happened, where people are like driving hundreds of miles out of their way to come and eat with us because they want the monument saved and they're grateful. So there's sort of this interesting tribalism that's happened around congruent values. And we were featured in the New Yorker magazine in the issue that came out October 1st, which is so wild. You know, I would have never in my... I'm a lifelong adult subscriber to the New Yorker. I love that long-form journalism. But it would have never seemed like we would ever be in the magazine, and there's this huge article. But that created like a tornado of support. You know, we have a stack of foot high on my desk of letters from people from all over the country thanking us for standing up for the monument that they love.
So how can people help who may be listening to this?
Thank you for asking.
What would you have them do?
I think the most important thing is to really work to elect officials, representatives and senators who are pro public lands. That's number one, because unfortunately wilderness and wild places have become part of the culture wars in a way that I would have never imagined. And it's really surprising because, you know, of course, Teddy Roosevelt was Mr. Original Conservation Guy, conservative. And had he not protected Grand Canyon, I shudder to think what it would look like today. And then there's several really wonderful small nonprofits that are fighting very hard to save Grand Staircase that really need support. And one of those is Grand Staircase Escalante Partners. And we are working really closely with them. They are the point of the spear on the lawsuit. The other one is the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. There's another great one called Great Old Broads for Wilderness. And then the Sierra Club has come out really strongly also for the monument. And so, as has NRDC, everybody's getting involved, but the Wilderness Society. But I think the two that I would mainly direct people to support, the ones that really need help because they're not national, would be Grand Staircase Escalante Partners, and they have a website. And actually, there's a link to them on our website, hellsbackbonegrill.com.
That was my question. Mm-hmm.
And then the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. But then I think just really letting your representatives know that public lands matter to you. This fight is not isolated in any way to Utah. And these lands are every American's lands. And so it is something for us to really pay attention to because it's an issue that will affect the well-being of the planet.
So when we go to Hell's Backbone Grill, the website, you can lead us to these various sites?
Yes, okay. We can. Thank you so much for asking. It really matters to Jen and Lavinia and I so much that people understand what's happening. Our county is 5,000 square miles. There's only 5,000 people that live in it.
Wow.
And so the thing that the New Yorker article did really effectively for us was we sort of felt like we were like Horton, here's a who. Like we were going, help, they're going to boil us in oil. And then the Catherine Schultz's piece gave us that epically huge Curly Q megaphone to be like, actually, it's serious. And then now we're feeling like people are noticing what's happening because it's not our fight. It's a fight for all of you.
When we dine at the restaurant, when do you start taking reservations for spring?
January 15th is when the reservation lines open.
And then we should make a reservation at the resort also so we have a place to stay overnight?
Yeah, so we're on the grounds of a beautiful, I wouldn't call it a resort, but it's a Boulder Mountain Lodge. It's a very comfortable, beautiful eco-lodge. And there's only 22 bedrooms. There are other little hotels and like places around, and then there's endless camping. And so, but getting a room there, you know, is more complicated than getting a reservation at the restaurant most of the time. Sometimes, but you know, we're buddies. I'll make sure you get in.
It's funny. Camping sounds so fun, except not really, because it's cold and the ground's hard. And
I get it.
Blake, Lavinia, Jennifer, thank you for joining us today. Mm-hmm. Can you three agree on your favorite number today between 1 and 15?
11.
11.
You speak for all.
Yeah.
Well, sorry. We're not agreeing,
three.
I guess.
Sorry.
11? Can we say 11?
Yeah.
Okay, caller 11. Number 11 at 636-1350 will win an autographed copy.
How wonderful.
The Immeasurable Place, food and farming from the edge of wilderness. Recipes from Hell's Backbone Grill. You'll meet and fall in love with all the characters in this book. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks for coming to Santa Rosa.
It was such a pleasure talking to the both of you.
Thank you.
John Ash, we'll see you next week.
I hope so.
All right. God willing.
God willing, yes.
I'm Steve Garner from the KS Ardo Kitchen.